The next case for argument is IQE versus Newport Fab, number 24-1124. Mr. Lloyd, when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Adam Lloyd on behalf of the defendant appellant Tower Entities. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I first want to address the threshold issue of jurisdiction, given IQE raised that in an unsuccessful motion to dismiss, and then again in its briefs. We think the issue of this court's jurisdiction is actually pretty straightforward in this case because this appeal comes to this court by way of transfer from the Ninth Circuit, and thus the U.S. Supreme Court's Christensen decision controls. To transfer here under 1631, the Ninth Circuit was required to and did find two things. First, that the Federal Circuit would have had jurisdiction at the time that this appeal was filed, and two, that the transfer would be in the interest of justice. The Ninth Circuit determined both of these were satisfied. They analyzed whether this court would have jurisdiction under 1295A, which states that this court has appellate jurisdiction over final decisions and actions arising under patent law. It determined that a denial under longstanding Ninth Circuit precedent, the denial of an anti-SLAPP motion, is a final interlocutory or a final decision under the collateral order doctrine. And then determined that this action arises under patent law because they asserted a claim under 256. They also determined, as part of the interest of justice analysis, that our appeal in the Ninth Circuit, there's no evidence of wrongdoing, no bad faith, and then held that the Federal Circuit, not this court, has jurisdiction over the merits of the appeal at Appendix 16.
Whose law applies to whether this is a final decision under the collateral order doctrine, the Ninth Circuit or our law?
Here under Christensen, you would defer to the Ninth Circuit.
Well, no. I'll just set aside Christensen for a minute. Because if we had binding precedent that said this kind of collateral order is our law and is not a final order, then under Christensen, we would probably retransfer it. So the question is, does Ninth Circuit law apply to what's a final? Whether this is a final order under the collateral order doctrine or us. And we don't have any law.
Because there's no law here, I would think you would still look to the Ninth Circuit's law as persuasive authority in California law.
Well,
that's
not the question I'm asking you. This is we get this question all the time when we have issues like this. Is it the regional circuit law or is it our law?
Well, it's not an issue unique to patent law. So under Allergan case law, under that line of case law, we would say you defer to the regional circuit.
Okay. What about the Dupuy Synthes case? You didn't address it. It's cited in the red brief at 14, which seems to say exactly the opposite of the answer you just gave. We said there in a binding precedent, questions of our jurisdiction are governed by federal circuit law.
Mm-hmm. So I would say in response to that, the question of whether California's anti-SLAPP law conflicts with the federal rules so as to apply at all is a question of that is not unique to patent law, and that's not a jurisdictional question. That's a question of whether it conflicts with the federal rules. You do defer to the regional circuit there. And so that's your starting place, that California's anti-SLAPP law applies in federal court. And then so the question is it a collateral order? And here we would say you would defer to the regional circuit. Because that is, again, it's not an issue unique to patent.
I'm confused. So. Why isn't the starting point, as it is in every case, do we have jurisdiction? Subject matter jurisdiction is undisputed now, but do we have appellate jurisdiction? And in Dupuy Synthes, we said when the parties dispute that, the answer is governed by federal circuit law. Isn't that where we start?
Yes, but I'm just saying, okay, yes, we start with whether this court has jurisdiction, but then the next step of that analysis is, okay, let's starting with, does the anti-SLAPP apply in federal court at all? Yes. And then you ask, okay, given that it does, is it a collateral order? And
I'm missing somewhere a step. Mm-hmm. What law do we apply? Federal circuit law or Ninth Circuit law?
Well, I would say under the Dupuy, there is no federal circuit law to apply here. So as to whether this is a collateral order.
That doesn't answer the question. If we haven't decided it yet, but it's a question of our law, then we have to decide it on our own. Just because we haven't reached a certain issue doesn't mean it's not our law and we just follow whatever the regional circuit did. We could disagree with the regional circuit if it's our question.
I would say that... Yes, I mean, I guess the issue you guys, it sounds like that you have with the Ninth Circuit's
It's not ruling. Really appropriate to refer to the court as you guys.
Sorry. My apologies, Your Honor. That the issue with the Ninth Circuit's law, or Ninth Circuit's decision, is it didn't analyze whether this is a collateral order under federal circuit law, or whether this court would decide that in the first instance.
I'm not intending any criticism of the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. I just want to know when I sit down to decide whether mm-hmm. I can decide this case, mm-hmm. it seems to me the first thing I have to ask is, am I applying federal circuit law or am I applying Ninth Circuit law? I understand Christensen mm-hmm. is out there, and yeah. maybe that's the right answer.
Right.
But putting that aside just for the moment,
sure.
we have a binding precedent in this Dupuis Synthes case, which again, you didn't address mm-hmm. or distinguish in your briefing. So I don't know what to do with it. We seem to very clearly say questions of our jurisdiction are governed by federal circuit law. That's a case that looks just like this one. It was transferred from, I think, the 11th Circuit. Mm-hmm. It's a dispute over whether the collateral order doctrine applies to a different type of order. Sure. And it seems to be telling me I have to apply federal circuit law. Whether we have any or not, next question.
Right.
But am I right that I have to apply federal circuit law to answer these questions?
Yes, setting aside the Christensen and the Federal Circuit precedent applying that, saying you're not looking at this afresh, you're deferring to the Ninth Circuit's determination under that this court would have jurisdiction under 1295A. But assuming that this court is looking at this issue afresh, I do think you would still look to Ninth Circuit precedent to determine whether it's a collateral issue or a collateral appealable under the collateral order doctrine.
But we've looked at all the circuits' decisions, and they're split, right?
They're split, but we're asking whether California, each circuit has
a different... Are you saying that because this is a specific California statute, that what we would be determining is what the California statute says, and that definitely is clear that it's a collateral order that's subject to immediate appeal, whereas other state anti-SLAPP issues may not be so clear?
Yes, That's exactly what I'm saying. The states have different anti-SLAPPs, and they vary as to whether they're immediately appealable and the policy reasons.
So even if it's a question that we have to decide, I find this very... This is like the hardest of like federal courts questions, and we're going to get to other stuff too. Mm-hmm. But it seems kind of hard to say that would be a question of our law then mm-hmm. If what we're doing is looking at California law. Because
right.
we're certainly in no position to say what California law is any better than the Ninth Circuit.
Yes, and the California...
The answer is, we have jurisdiction over a collateral order if it's final and meets all these conditions, but whether this particular type of order is a final one is something that the regional circuit should determine. And here, mm-hmm. the regional circuit's already determined that these are final orders.
Yeah, and it has for over 15 years.
And so once it's a final order, then clearly we have jurisdiction under our own case law.
That is our understanding. And the reason the Ninth Circuit holds that is based on California Supreme Court authority, which holds, in Varian, you have a right not to be dragged through the courts.
You spent a lot of your time on this. Do you want to get on to the rest of this case?
Yes. So setting that aside, I'd like to talk about the merits. The anti-SLAPP analysis proceeds in two steps. The first prong, it's our burden to establish that the causes of action arise from protected activity. That's a fairly straightforward analysis thanks to, again, a recent decision from the California Supreme Court. You need to look at the elements of the claims we're challenging, the alleged acts to establish those elements, and whether those acts are protected under the anti-SLAPP statute. I'll start with the protected acts, just because I think that's the easiest. The Ninth Circuit has already determined that, quote, the act of filing an application with the USPTO is a protected act within the meaning of the anti-SLAPP statute in the Mindy's decision. It's a formal communication with USPTO seeking official action. So therefore, it qualifies. They don't really dispute this point. They have other issues with whether it's protected. I'll get to that in a second. Going to the elements of the claims we challenge their interference claims, both intentional and negligent, and their misappropriation claims. The elements of interference, they have to identify a relationship with the probability of future economic benefit, our knowledge, and then crucial here, an intentional or negligent wrongful act that actually disrupted their relationship with their customers. If you look to the elements of their claims at Appendix 50, Paragraph 136, 137, it says, quote, the existence of the patents themselves is what disrupts their relationships with their customers. and the information, quote, disclosed in the patents. They don't allege any other acts that we took to interfere with their relationship.
I appreciate what the complaint says. Their briefing tells us, as I understand their argument, that they don't really accuse your patent applications in their state law claims. That's not really what it's about, that from the minute you took their trade secrets, even if you kept it all internal and never applied for a patent, you're liable nonetheless, and that you're basically ratcheting up evidence that they might offer into the sort of gravamen of their claim, and you're looking at it the wrong way. Could you respond to that?
Yeah. So the reason the California Supreme Court came up with this elements-based test was to get rid of a lot of these issues that they raised in their argument with the first prong analysis, which is courts in the past were like looking to the gravamen, these kind of metaphysical questions, trying to figure out what this claim is really about. The California Supreme Court says, no, we look at the elements. What did they actually allege in the complaint? They're bound by their pleadings. That's how this analysis has to proceed. I understand that they, you know, disagree with that and they want to expand in their brief about what their claims are about, but in their complaint, they allege it was the patents themselves.
But what about paragraph 92 of the complaint, which appears on appendix page 43, that alleges Tower has copied IPE's trade secrets, incorporated them into Tower's patents and patent application, is using them and intends to continue to use them to further their business interests and to damage IPE's market standing. Doesn't that go beyond the filing of the patent applications?
What they're saying is using them, and as the only act of use that they identify is the patent applications themselves. There's no other act alleged in this entire complaint as to how we're using these applications.
Right, but it's notice pleading under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, so they don't have to articulate every single way that the patent or the trade secret information might be used. And so in this paragraph, don't they say something beyond just the patent application?
I would say no, nothing that's not conclusory or plausible. They have to allege like how we're using these claims, and they said the only way in that we're using them is in the patent applications themselves. So under Bonney, under Supreme Court's decision, those claims are based on our protected activity. And again, looking at the misappropriation claim, they have to allege that we acquired, disclosed, or used through improper means. And if you look at paragraphs 89 through 90 on appendix 42, on appendix 42, they specify the disclosure and use of our trade secrets in the quote patents and patent applications themselves is the misappropriation. They didn't have to allege their claims that way, but they have, and that way, and in so doing, they have now shown that their claims are based on our protected activity. The district court's analysis was in error because, again, at appendix 1011, the district court recognized that the claims were based on information disclosed in the patents. They just said that information was IQE's alleged trade secrets, i.e., the information disclosed in the patents was unlawful. Like, the patent application itself was unlawful. Doe v. Gangland addresses that specifically and says, at the first step of this analysis, the court does not assess whether it was unlawful. That is for a second prong merits to determine whether they have a probability of prevailing on their claims.
So you're into your rebuttal. Do you want to say the
rest
of it?
Yes, I would like to. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Let's hear from the other side.
Trish Hughes, may I please support? Starting off with the decision of who, or the question of whose jurisdiction should you look to, the case law makes clear that this court does not defer to other courts in determining whether or not this court has jurisdiction over a case. You have to determine whether or not you have that jurisdiction in the first instance. And under the standard collateral order doctrine rules laid down by the Supreme Court, it's quite clear that this is not a order that is susceptible to the collateral order doctrine. Specifically, the decision...
But this is a matter of state law, right? Doesn't it seem particularly odd that we would be determining as a matter of federal circuit law whether a collateral order under a state law doctrine is sufficiently final for appealable to this court?
be appealable to this court?
I think this court has to determine in every instance whether it has jurisdiction, regardless of whether it's a state court cause of action through a, you know, through a simple fact that state law.
Are you aware of any other cases where we've said a question of state law, because it's a question of jurisdiction, is nonetheless federal circuit law versus the regional circuit law?
Well, I mean, I think Dupuis is an example, but I also think...
What state law question were they deciding there?
They were deciding, I believe they were deciding a issue under, I don't have the exact type of state law
what
action.
What was the
there.
Collateral order there?
Yes, there was a collateral order, and the question is
yeah,
whether or not...
what was it?
The collateral order was whether or not there was a final decision.
No, I know, but what was the subject of that order?
Oh, I sorry, I don't know exactly.
I mean, you got to know the cases if you're going to come up here and argue them to us. I mean, it could have been a question of federal law or something else. In that case, we might have more competence.
Except for the fact that other circuits have considered this question before. For example, in Ernst, Ernst was considering whether or not California anti-SLAPP actions applied. And Ernst, the Second Circuit, said, no, we're not going to follow the Ninth Circuit. We are going to follow, we're going to decide on our own whether or not the collateral order doctrine applies. And then went through the standard collateral order doctrine analysis. And finding that it disagreed with the Ninth Circuit in Basel and said, no, because the issue of anti-SLAPP analysis is coupled to the question of the merits, it is not appropriate to for a court to review a denial of an anti-SLAPP motion under the, you know, immediately appealable.
So you think we need to get to that question for ourselves?
Yes, I think you do. I think this
well,
court...
Well, if we do, why isn't it within the collateral order doctrine? Because it certainly would escape review if we don't hear an immediate appeal.
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the question at the end of the day is whether or not the Knorr-Pennington doctrine applies here. And this court routinely considers the Knorr-Pennington doctrine at the end of the case after everything else has happened. And
is
so,
isn't anti-SLAPP analogous to an immunity, which includes an immunity from having to go forward with these claims?
Absolutely not. And the California Supreme Court has said it's not a substantive immunity. It's a procedural bar.
It hasn't said that. If you're relying on the Navalier case, you're misreading that case. And the Ninth Circuit has continued to apply the analogy of it being an immunity for 20 years now after that Navalier case, unless you have some other case from the California Supreme Court that I overlooked.
Well, I don't have a California Supreme Court case. I do have appellate courts in California that have said that...
Hasn't the Ninth Circuit continued to say anti-SLAPP is just like an immunity?
That's correct.
And that's why it's within the scope of a collateral order.
That's correct. That's the basis for Batesel and the line of the progeny from Batesel.
So why is that wrong?
Because, for one thing, it is not actually... There is no immunity that is any different than a Knorr-Pennington doctrine immunity here. Everything here collapses into that fact. They say, look, we get anti-SLAPP should apply here because we have First Amendment rights and be able to file a patent application, leaving aside that the cause of action was not based purely on the filing of the patent application. But the second thing they say is, okay, once we're in the anti-SLAPP territory, we get off scot-free because the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine allows us to petition the government. And to be quite clear, the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine is something that this court reviews after final judgment at the end of the day to determine whether or not there is a bar on liability. Now, to be sure, Knorr-Pennington is in some sense an immunity. If the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine applies, then you don't end up in a place where you're going to be found liable for anything. But that does not mean that the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine or anything else ought to cut off all of the merits determinations ahead of time, and therefore that it ought to be immediately appealable to this court. At the end of the day, when this case is finally done, we all agree that it should come back to this court. This court has subject matter jurisdiction because the case arises out of the patent clause. And they can bring their Knorr-Pennington claim then. The problem is they can't bring it now, because the collateral order doctrine says...
If we do apply federal circuit law and look at this de novo, can we choose to treat the Ninth Circuit years of precedent as persuasive authority?
Absolutely. But you could also find that the Ernst decision in the Second Circuit is persuasive on the same issue.
What about Christensen? Doesn't Christensen from the Supreme Court tell us we really should treat as law of the case the decision of the Ninth Circuit to transfer this case to us?
So three points on Christensen, Your Honor. First, Christensen does not explicitly says that the court must determine whether or not it has jurisdiction. It cannot find jurisdiction where it does not. Second off, though,
but in Christensen, wasn't the issue that the Federal Circuit would never have jurisdiction, that it prop the appeal, regardless of when the appeal was taken, was properly in the Seventh Circuit?
Well, the issue there in Christensen is the worry that there'd be bouncing back and forth between the circuits. So that, for example...
But ultimately, the Supreme Court decided that because the subject matter was not sufficiently intertwined with the patent issue, it belonged with the Seventh Circuit. Here, ultimately, you concede that the appeal will come to the Federal Circuit.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's why that Christensen does not apply for that sort of reason. Like, the rationale behind Christensen is that the Supreme Court didn't want a case being pushed back and forth between the regional circuits or between the circuit and the regional circuit. Here, that's not going to happen. Any decision from the final, from the district court, the final decision, will come here. There's no ping-ponging back to the Ninth Circuit. Because this case arises out of
the
patent law.
Christensen deals with the subject matter jurisdiction. We're at the point where it seems like you both agree we have subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes.
And what we would be deciding is whether we have appellate jurisdiction.
Correct.
And if we decide we don't, it's not going to get retransferred. It's just going to get dismissed.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, they could raise it again after the final judgment, you know, when the case is done. But they just can't bring it now.
Well, they can't raise the anti-SLAPP arguments again because those will be gone. I mean, this is, I'm a little confused by your argument that the anti-SLAPP case is kind of overlapping or the same as the Norr-Pennington doctrine, because the whole point of the anti-SLAPP act is to get you out of costly litigation when they're essentially frivolous claims. And if we don't allow immediate appeal of that, then even if they do win after the fact, they've undergone the harm of going through the litigation that the Anti-SLAPP Act was designed to prevent.
Yes, that is true, they do not get out due to the procedural devices of the Anti-SLAPP statute. What I'm saying, though, is the question of whether or not they're immune from having, you know, that their First Amendment rights provided immunity is a Norr-Pennington Doctrine immunity. And I'm saying Norr-Pennington Doctrine immunity from liability, not from suit, but from liability, is an issue that they can ultimately address later on in the case.
I'm still struggling with why Norr-Pennington matters here in determining whether California's anti-SLAPP doctrine is a decision under that is a collateral order subject to immediate appeal.
Well, I mean, there's three reasons. One is because it is subject to review again. There's a second anti-SLAPP motion sitting before the district court right now that the court is going to have to address.
Your argument seems to suggest, though, that if the anti-SLAPP motion is denied, that appellate courts can't review it.
I would say...
How would an appellate court, setting aside any of the jurisdictional stuff, I don't care if it's us or the Ninth Circuit, if it's denied under your view that it's not a final appealable order, how would an appellate court ever review it?
I mean, in the same, I suppose that in the sense of that there would still, the case would still go on, i.e. in the same way that if a Rule 12 motion is denied, the case goes on. And so the point is, true, the case goes on and then there'll be a final judgment on the merits and you say, well, I'm worried that I wasn't able to look and evaluate the Rule 12 motion that was denied. But the point is, there was minimal merit, it went forward, and that's how the case proceeds. There's a procedural device that allowed you to screen out bad cases, just like the anti-SLAPP motion. But just because you have that, just because there is no way to immediately review that does not mean that the anti-SLAPP motion has no teeth, right? Because they could have succeeded, for example.
Okay. Do you want to address
the merits? Yeah. Sure. On the merits, the court, it wasn't just the complaint that Judge Wang discussed, but the district court itself noted what was the issue, and it is Appendix 10, responding to Tower's arguments. Plaintiff's injury does not result from the mere filing of a patent application, as defendants argue. Rather, plaintiff's injury results from the defendant's alleged trade secret theft and alleged misrepresentations to the USPTO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The point of this is, once they started using the trade secret in any format, And namely, they started drafting the patent application. They're using it.
Why isn't this more properly addressed under step two than under step one?
To be fair, Your Honor, I think sometimes the step one and step two analysis
If we think the district court got it wrong in dismissing it under step one, and we don't buy your argument that we can decide for ourselves under step two, doesn't it have to go back?
Yes, it would have to go back if that's true. But to be quite clear, under step two, it's fairly clear that fraud and lying to an agency is clearly within any exception.
But that's step two.
That would be under step two.
It's clear that the district court should not have considered that at step one, isn't it?
Well, it is quite clear that just simply saying I filed a patent application does not immediately answer the question, well, was that in furtherance of a right to speech that is protected? Lying is not protected. So therefore, in other words, even if you don't buy the argument that, as the district court said, that this the gravamen of the complaint was about the misappropriation rather than the filing of the patent application, it's still true that simply saying, well, I filed a patent application does not immediately mean that step one was satisfied.
Right, so let's talk about how step one was satisfied. Because when I look at counts two and then the interference counts, they all seem to arise from this use of the patent, the trade secret information within the patents and the patent application. So where in the complaint are there any allegations that there was somehow other misappropriation?
So pointing to appendix 43, paragraph 92, Trower has copied IQE's trade secrets. The minute they copied those trade secrets from the PowerPoint presentations with the trade secrets into a patent application, never filed the patent application, just copied it, used the trade secrets for a purpose other than engaging in the business negotiation. Once they started doing something on their own with those trade secrets, that was the misappropriation. The point is that they started using them for a purpose that was not allowable. Even if they had never petitioned the government at the end of the day, they'd still use the trade secrets by creating a patent application. Now, to be sure, filing the patent application and putting it out into the world greatly exacerbated the damages and greatly exacerbated the harm to IQE. But the point is that the misappropriation happened the minute that they started doing something with the trade secret other than engaging in the business negotiation for which the trade secrets had been furnished.
But what you allege is a misappropriation by using your trade secrets at the patent office. You didn't have to bring that claim, but isn't that very clearly the claim that you brought?
Well, the claim is, of course, I mean, obviously most of the harm is going to come about due to that fact. But it is the copying of the trade secrets, the incorporating them into a patent application, the using them, the intending to use them, those are all still claims that were brought in the complaint. And so if you're looking at the complaint, that's what the district court found.
Best understanding of California law as interpreted by the California courts and the Ninth Circuit that when you do that, when your claim is tied up with a misappropriation that ultimately leads to a communication to the patent office, you are going to lose at step one, and maybe you win at step two. Otherwise, you're going to lose on this claim.
Well, for one thing, courts that have considered that, I mean, this is a fact pattern that has happened before, including in Eagle Harbor. So courts that have considered this said, no, the issue here is the theft of the misappropriation of the trade secret, the use of the trade secret. To be sure, the second, going on to then filing the patent application, that is incidental, or that is, further aggravates the harm, but it is not per se the initial misappropriation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Lloyd, you've got a little under 2 minutes left.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a few things. As Judge Hughes recognized, the California Supreme Court has recognized this is a right to not be dragged through the courts because you exercise your constitutional rights under Varian. Burdens of litigation are in large measure lost if the petitioner is forced to litigate a case to its conclusion before obtaining a definitive judgment through the appellate process. That's Varian. Later in Berry in 2017, they said the basic purpose underlying the anti-SLAPP statute.
Do you know what the
subject of the collateral order in Dupuy was?
Dupuy, it was a motion to seal. A motion to seal, okay. A denial of the federal procedural law.
Not a state law.
Correct.
Issue.
That's correct. You mentioned retransfer. I do just want to address that briefly. The Ninth Circuit did say that it would retain jurisdiction should this court's jurisdiction not be triggered under 1295A, because in the Ninth Circuit...
Yeah, but I don't think we have any question. We have jurisdiction under 1295A, mm-hmm. and then it turns into whether it's a final appealable order to us.
Sure.
And you agree that if we think it's not final, then we just dismiss, not retransfer.
So if it's not final, then 1295A's requirements aren't satisfied. Yes?
That's subject matter jurisdiction. I think you're confusing two different things. Don't waste your time on this. We're going to have to figure this out. It's complicated. Right.
I will, and just because you brought on, up...
I mean, mm-hmm. it seems to me that the district court collapsed 1 and 2,
yes.
and I don't think there's precedent for allowing that to be done. But it does seem to me that they're going to have a good argument on why they should prevail under 2 if it goes back.
Sure, and they can raise that on step 2, but that's our point, is that the district court's step 1 analysis was problematic because it did collapse it under Doe. It did look into whether the alleged petitioning activity here, the filing patents, wasn't lawful, and it said because it's been alleged, therefore,
Going back to jurisdiction just real quick, they say that we reviewed Norr Pennington mm-hmm. issues in a post-trial ordinary type of appeal, and that if we have to decide whether this is a collateral order, we should look to that analogy and not say that this is going to evade review if we wait till later. What's your response to that?
I would say that if we had made Norr Pennington arguments in a normal motion to dismiss, then that might have purchase. But here we made them as part of an anti-SLAPP motion, which, again, is designed to prevent you from having to defend.
I get how there's case law that supports what you're saying, but if we just think of it from a higher level, isn't it a perfectly good analogy what we do on Norr Pennington, and doesn't it imply that your issues are actually capable of a real review in a post-trial context?
I would say certain defenses, but the whole, again, and I'm sorry to keep going back to this, but the whole point of California enacting the statute was to prevent you from having to go through the entire trial, go up on appeal, and then determine you were correct. You've already incurred the burdens. You've lost the benefits of the statute the California legislature has determined.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case submitted.